Thank you, Janine. Good morning. Is this on? Oh, my name's Paul Muth. I'm sliding into the seat here. I think I'm all set up. We'll see. Got no fresh Mumia Abu-Jamal today, but I noticed that Prison Radio is doing some fundraising, and they also have the Democracy Now! Segment, March for Mumia, for his health care. He's losing his vision and needs treatment. On data centers, we don't have new construction, but we have Meta taking over the plant at Clinton, nuclear plant at, it was going to be mothballed because it wasn't competitive with natural gas. Maybe even some solar and wind farms were making it non-economic to offer. But Meta stepped in, and now it's got a new lease on life. And now I understand Constellation, who they're doing it through, has gotten Dresden, which is the first privately financed nuclear plant in the U.S. It's currently operating 2 and 3. These plants began commercial operation in 1970 and 71. DDD, Meta says, or AI says that they're providing clean energy for Northern Illinois. I'm concerned about the micro reactor that still I run into people that don't know that the U of I with nano nuclear are planning to put at the site of the Abbott coal burning, well, coal and gas. They burn a mixture still over on campus, and they're going to use it to heat the campus. All right. I got an article on a couple numbers ago in the Public Eye local. It's also available online, though the latest edition is out in print only because somebody tried to hack one of the programs we use for pagination to the web, and we're a little at dilemma. At least last time I checked, that was the case. Maybe somebody has solved it by now. Thanks for everybody who's working on that. Let's do an underwriting announcement in small business in Monticello, is it? And then I'll run down Larry Summers' Epstein emails and the origin of the Great Recession. I haven't had any Greg Palast in a while, so this is isn't an election crimes bulletin. And actually, I don't have anything from Flashpoints this week, my go-to person. They're doing fundraising out there, but they still do a lot of good programming during their fundraising drive. That's KPFA. Berkeley, the first major FM radio station in the country, in a way. Okay, that's the cut.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com, that's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
Thanks, Rick. Voice of Wednesday afternoon beat blender. Oh my, what can the matter be? I seem to have missed my Amy Goodman file. Amy Goodman's got a piece on school shootings. She did some interviews this week that were quite powerful. Looks like I'm going to have to go to the source and actually download this real time. I'll try and run down what else I've got. Anti-nuclear activist and election analyst Harvey Wasserman has a show called Green Power that he circulates on AudioPort, where I get some programming from. And it's actually really a big Zoom 105 people at one of the counts that he gave. It's a two-hour thing. He has a colleague of his that he's written with for a long time named Bob Fachakis in Ohio. Wasserman's out fighting against nuclear plants in California, I think, these days for a while. Green power, sun power. That is the name of his website, if I write. I better double check that. And now I've got it, so let's kick it. Law and Disorder Radio, I've been going to them fairly frequently, and I've got Norman Solomon today, and there's a segment with a person that's just back from a trip to the West Bank with a Jewish Voices for Peace delegation, I think. Now, locally, there was, maybe regionally, there was a Catholic Worker delegation. I'm hoping to have a gentleman from that trip, and maybe with a colleague on the phone or something, or maybe they'll come to town to do a talk on their trip to the West Bank. I gather it was rather harrowing, which I can imagine. So that's kind of the rundown. Greg Palast coming up, probably in the middle of the mix. And but as usual, let's kick it with Amy Goodman. Norman Solomon's talking about Trump hell and how the corporate Democrats paved the way for that reality, I think. All right, that's a longer soliloquy than I wanted to kick off because I, as usual, have more than I can play. Probably excerpt the Harvey Wasserman interview. Since that, I edited out some of the noise that comes into a Zoom and noise, but anyway, off comments and meanderings like I'm doing right now. Here's Amy Goodman breaking the sound barrier.
Second school shooting. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. On Saturday afternoon, December 13th, a gunman entered a Brown University classroom in Providence, Rhode Island, and started firing. He killed two students and injured nine, then escaped. Days later, Providence Police Chief Colonel Oscar Perez admitted at a news conference,
"He could be anywhere. You're right. And I think the fact that we're all here in this room and we're providing the info and it's being spread out through this nation, I would hope. I'm speaking to different chiefs. I've had the privilege to know a lot of them. We're exchanging info as we speak. We don't know. But we still don't know what the person is or who he is."
According to the Gun Violence Archive, this was the 389th mass shooting in the United States in 2025. At least four more have occurred since. Gun violence is not unique to this country, but its sheer magnitude and frequency here is without equal. The gun industry and its gun lobby have created a 50-state free fire zone, a killing field in the very country where, 250 years ago, its founders declared life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to be inalienable rights. Those rights have been forever stripped from Ella Cook and Muhammad Aziz Amirzokov, the two students killed in the attack. Of the nine injured, six remain hospitalized, one in critical condition. Mass shootings, especially at schools, have become so common in the United States that we now have a growing population of people who've survived not one, but two of them. We interviewed two such survivors on the Democracy Now! NewsHour after the Brown shooting.
Because I've already processed all the grief and the sadness before, I've kind of, you know, been grappling with that for the past 7 years. My, like, most predominant emotion right now is honestly anger.
Brown sophomore Zoe Weissman said she was at the Westglades Middle School in Parkland, Florida, which abuts the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where on Valentine's Day 2018, a former student arrived with an AR-15-style assault rifle and killed 17 people, mostly students, injuring 18. Zoe continued,
If politicians actually want to show that they care about their constituents and they want to be reelected, they need to show a concerted effort to pass gun violence prevention legislation on a federal level. And if they don't do so, we'll make sure to vote them out, because we are the only country where this happens.
Mia Tretta is a junior at Brown. She was shot by a fellow student with a handgun at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita, California, on November 14, 2019. He killed her best friend and one other student and injured two more before taking his own life.
I came to Brown as someone who was shot in the stomach at 15 years old.
Mia said on Democracy Now!
When something as horrific and terrifying as a school shooting happens to you, you want to find as much sense of safety as possible. Because at least for me, it was, you know, my entire innocence, my childhood was taken from me by someone I didn't even know. And a big reason I chose Brown was because of the safety I felt on campus, the community I felt, the fact that Rhode Island is a blue state that, you know, values gun laws.
Since surviving the shooting in high school, Mia has become a tireless gun control advocate. In 2022, at the age of 18, she spoke at the White House.
Ghost guns are untraceable. Arms that look like a gun, shoot like a gun, and kill like a gun, but have not been regulated like a gun. I've also learned that as a student, I don't just have to worry about Spanish tests, but about my life. School shootings with ghost guns are on the rise. And the most lasting thing I've learned, other than the loss of friends or the shattering of my youth, is that nothing has relieved the pain in my heart like working to prevent more senseless shootings.
Like Mia, Zoe Weissman promises action.
We are a very politically active group of students. We've been very active in response to the federal compact proposed to Brown. We were a big part of making sure that our school rejected that. We've been very vocal in regards to the genocide occurring in Gaza, and as well as advocating for local causes. And I think that you're really going to see a large concerted effort once we get back on campus in mid to late January from students. I think that I can speak for all of us that we're angry and we're ready to do something, not just on the state level, but on a federal one as well.
The U.S. Supreme Court is scheduled to hear what's been described as a pileup of Second Amendment cases, including one challenging an Illinois ban on AR-15 assault rifles, the mass shooter's weapon of choice. Other cases involve whether certain classes of people can have their gun rights restricted, like those with felony convictions, habitually addicted people, or those under the age of 21. If history is a guide, the court's 6-3 right-wing majority is likely to reject any form of gun control as unconstitutional. So it will take grassroots action to contain this uniquely American scourge of mass gun violence.
America is the only country that takes gun violence as this fact of life. And it makes no sense.
21-year-old Mia Tretta said.
There's no world where walking down the street and being scared or sitting in a classroom and getting shot and killed is normal. This doesn't have to happen.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, I guess an update on the shooter. He's been linked to the killing of somebody on the MIT campus, a Portuguese national who, maybe he's naturalized. Someone he was in school with in Portugal, apparently, and has been found dead in a storage self-inflicted wound. AR-15's coming back to Illinois? No thanks. Already 15 minutes after, so I should get on with it. I may have given the misimpression that I was playing something anti-nuclear from Harvey Wasserman. I should do that sometime. But actually, Fitrakis is in Ohio, and he looks into the Epstein origins in Ohio. Lex Flexner, etc. I didn't know Alita Express was actually a plane that was used to ferry high-priced lingerie for Victoria's Secret from China to the U.S. in the early days of his fortune-making. Lex Flexner's boyfriend, Jeffrey Epstein. More on that anon. Let's get to Trump hell. Here we are. Who knows what happens next? He didn't declare war on Venezuela in primetime, but he already had earlier in the day because a blockade that he's suggesting they're going to operate is pretty much an act of war. All right, opinions you hear are those of the speakers. Again, this is Law and Disorder, and as I said, they have another segment that's quite good with the Jewish Voices for Peace activist who's just recently done fact-finding in the West Bank. That'll be on tomorrow at 5-ish. Here's Michael Smith.
In 2016, a man famous for humiliating people on television with catchphrases like, "You're fired," was elected president of the United States. Many were surprised, chief among them his opponent, Hillary Clinton. But others, like our guest for this segment, saw it coming and believes that the Democratic Party could have done so much more than it did to avoid it. Today, in the midst of Trump presidency number two, the country is as polarized as ever. How did we get here? And where are we headed? Is there a way to avoid the U.S. slipping into a country where only the wealthiest enjoy power, resources, liberty, and justice? Our guest for this segment will help us think through these questions. He is Norman Solomon, author of the new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. Norman Solomon is the National Director of Roots Action and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Solomon has written about politics for many publications, including The Hill, The Nation, The Guardian, Common Dreams, and the LA Times and Salon. Well, Norman Solomon, a very warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Listen, you've chosen a unique format for your book. The book, again, is The Blue Road to Trump Hill. Talk about the format and how it advances your overall theme and purpose.
Well, the politics of challenging corporate power should include, I think, not commercializing information and analysis as much as possible. You know, it costs to produce books and do radio stations and so forth. So inevitably, we need to ask people for money in media. But I'm very excited that here, during my 14th book, it's being published for free. And so anybody can go to blueroad.info and read The Blue Road to Trump Hell. Of course, it's available in print, but frankly, that was almost an afterthought because I believe that there are too many friggin' paywalls in media these days, and it plays to class privilege and depriving some people of information. So long story short, it's an innovation. It's really unusual, but I'm very pleased to be part of the process.
Absolutely.
Give us again the site that they can go to get the book for free.
Yes, it's blueroad.info. That's blueroad.info. And people will find the full book there. It's been published just here in December of 2025. And it's in various formats, so it doesn't require any technical knowledge. There's a PDF and there are ebooks and so forth.
Well, that's just great. Thank you, Norman. Norman, can you describe the audience that you had in mind when you were putting together your book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell?
Well, very much. I wanted a broad readership. Some people who have been very unhappy with the Democratic Party and wanted to find alternatives, while, of course, very eager to roll back the fascistic Trump regime's power, but also people who have believed that the Democratic Party lights the way to progressive change. And I think that that is a delusion. We have seen that the Democratic Party leadership, such as it is, has refused to enact basic social reforms for humanitarian change, such as Medicare for All, free public college, ending these regime change wars, stopping the military-industrial complex from determining foreign policy, and so forth. So we have had a failure on both counts of the Democratic Party leadership. They have blocked rather than advanced genuine progressive change, and they've also failed to stop this terrible right-wing juggernaut that now truly is fascistic, controlling the executive and legislative branches, and as folks at the National Lawyers Guild have been recognizing and warning us about, also the right-wing now controlling basically the judiciary, especially as you get up to the Supreme Court. So the audience is really a spectrum, as I see it, of people who are grappling with this terrible current situation that we're in, really in many ways unprecedented in our lifetimes, with the repression coming down from the federal government.
Your book begins in January of 2016, when Barack Obama was still president, but you argue that the stage was set for a Trump presidency at least a decade before that. Give us a sense of that history, a sense of what led up to that moment, if you will, when Trump was first elected.
Yeah, what led up is that when we are trying to stop bogus right-wing pseudo-populism, which is so xenophobic and racist and misogynist, it can't be done effectively in the long term in a situation of a lot of economic inequality getting worse. We can't do it with phony pseudo-populist corporatism in the Democratic Party leadership. And so when we look at how we got here at the end of 2025 in this terrible Trump situation, I think it is important. And the book goes back to where the assumption was that the last year of the Barack Obama administration would lead into the first year of a Hillary Clinton administration. And the people running the Democratic Party, they were frankly smug. They assumed that the general population was reasonably satisfied, and they weren't, because real wages were going down, health care and education prices were going up. And so they just didn't read the national room, so to speak. And Hillary Clinton's affinity to Wall Street, getting six-figure checks for a single speech, made it really implausible for her to be successfully posing as some kind of champion of the working class. And really, I start out this book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, by pointing out that Barack Obama came in 2009 at the time of a terrible crisis. The housing bubble had burst. There were millions of people who their life savings, basically, they had their savings in their homes, and their homes went underwater. And it was a tremendous crisis. And what Barack Obama did is he bailed out the banks. And he did not bail out the millions of people who were economically drowning. And so that was sort of a lead-in to enabling Trump to win in the first place, to pose as some kind of champion of working people.
Norman, Bernie Sanders was a candidate for president both in 2016 and in 2020. You describe how the corporate media shifted in their coverage of him as he gained in popularity. Tell us about this, please, and how it's relevant to where we are today.
Yeah, you know, when Bernie Sanders first announced for president in 2015, he was just mocked and written off by corporate media. And the line was, oh, he can't win the nomination. And then as he gathered grassroots strength, the line shifted from he can't win to, uh-oh, he could win. And this would be, we were told, a calamity. There's a classic study I cite in the book that was put forward by the Media Watch group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And when Bernie Sanders was at a high crest of his campaign in early 2016, The Washington Post published 16 negative articles about him in 16 hours. So when you have this big corporate outlet doing a negative article, a negative story about Bernie Sanders once an hour for 16 hours, that tells you something. They were panicked that Bernie Sanders, who's a Democratic socialist, might actually win the nomination and the presidency. And we've seen that repeated in 2020. It's part of what I call in the book a repetition compulsion disorder among those who still have a hammerlock control over the National Democratic Party, that they want to talk progressive, especially when they think it will appeal to the base at election time, but they govern very much from the corporate center. And that's involved massive militarism, nonstop wars, whether troops are on the ground or drones or missile attacks, as we're seeing now this year, as we've seen in previous years. And so it really goes to what extent we can overcome this juggernaut of the corporate media and corporate politicians and really build progressive movements from the grassroots so we can truly have Medicare for all. And we can have, as I mentioned, free public college, elder care, child care that isn't ripping people off or pushing them into poverty.
Well, Norman, your book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, touches on some warning signs that Democratic Party leaders could have heeded, but, well, chose not to, or at least didn't. What were some of those warning signs, and what can we learn from those failures going forward?
Well, really, some of the warning signs in the last year, two that come to mind, is that after the 2022 midterm elections, Joe Biden was making clear that he was going to run for re-election as president. And that was madness. And most people in the country, according to polls, most Democrats said clearly, we don't want this guy to run for re-election. But the punditocracy in corporate media, they were pretty pleased with the guy. And they had this myth that because Biden had defeated Trump once, he would be the best person to do it again, which was nonsense because Trump had represented in 2020 an unpopular status quo. But looking ahead to 2024, when you look at the right track, wrong track polling in the country, it was very clear that the status quo was even more unpopular and Joe Biden would represent that ongoing status quo. But that was ignored. Those were warning signs that were ignored. There were a lot of consultants who were making a lot of money, the inner circle of Joe Biden. And this is a theme of the book as well. What I call the Blue Road to Trump Hell is paved with obsequious conformity from Democrats in Congress. And so even though most Democrats in the country didn't want Biden to run again, lo and behold, it was hard to find a single Democrat in Congress to say that. So you have this gap of 60 to 70% of the Democrats in the country saying, Joe, don't run. And you had about 1% of the Democrats in Congress saying, Joe, don't run, at least saying it publicly. So that's one warning sign. The other was when you look at the polling in 2024, throughout the year and increasingly, most Democrats, and in fact, the entire population of the U.S., wanted a cutoff of military arms aid to Israel, increasingly recognizing it for the genocide, the mass murder that it was and continues to be. And so that was a warning sign as well, because when you have most electorates saying, we don't want our tax dollars, our billions of bucks going to slaughter Palestinian civilians, you would think that a candidate who wanted to reach the Oval Office would say something along that line. Well, the opposite was the case. After Biden bowed out, Kamala Harris had the now fabled 107 days to run till the election day. And she absolutely refused to put any daylight between her and Biden in terms of continuing to arm Israel. That was a dual tragic mistake. Tragic because it continued to encourage and stoke the slaughter of Palestinian people, courtesy of U.S. taxpayers through the misnamed, the Orwellian-named Israeli Defense Forces, and also was a tragedy because it helped to usher in the second presidency of Donald Trump. And the polling was clear at the time, as I cite in the book, as early as August of 2024, that if Kamala Harris had come out against continuing to arm Israel, many more people would have voted for her. But she refused to do that, and the rest is tragic history.
I totally agree with you, Norman. Why did she refuse to do it? She wouldn't even allow a Palestinian person on the stage at the Democratic National Convention. It was terrible. Let me ask you this, Norman. The last chapter of your book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, is called All of the Future at Stake. All of the Future at Stake. In broad strokes, what's your assessment of politics in the U.S. right now?
We can't really move forward in any appreciable way without some semblance of democracy in this country. And we have seen in the last 11 months the dismantling of one democratic structure after another. And it's a prerequisite. It doesn't guarantee that we're going to have a reduction of income inequality. It certainly doesn't guarantee that we'll end having a warfare state. But it is necessary. It's necessary, albeit not sufficient. You know, we've lived through one decade after another where there were more democratic structures in place. Most of the Supreme Court, whatever the deficiencies, they weren't right-wing lunatics like six out of the nine are now. That was necessary to have the basic elements where the gerrymandering wasn't to such an extreme level for House seats and so forth as it is now, as Texas has pointed out. So the opportunities that we have are foreclosed as long as we have these really fascistic people in control of the executive, legislative, and increasingly top of the judicial branch. And I think what is at stake is literally the future for all at many different levels. This is, as has been pointed out recently by the chair, Greg Kassar, of the Progressive Caucus in Congress. This is ethnic cleansing going on in the United States. The way in which the Trump administration has gotten the Supreme Court to agree to all these draconian repressive measures. I mean, it was unthinkable. Michael and Jim, when I look back at our lifetimes, what has been normalized is just astonishing that the Supreme Court, these flunkies for the Republican Party, have ruled this fall that it is okay to do racial targeting and that simply the language that someone speaks or the color of their skin is sufficient cause for them to be stopped on the street and questioned or pulled over. I mean, this is a repressive prerequisite for a fascistic government. And so everything is at stake. And the militarism means that literally everything is at stake. Pushing more and more closely to the precipice and over the precipice for nuclear war, that means it's all over for everybody.
I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my friend and co-host Michael Smith, and we're interviewing at the moment Norman Solomon, who is the author of the new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. Norman, one of the recurring themes in The Blue Road to Trump Hell is to not give in to autocracy, but to fight it. What should people of conscience be fighting for? What advice can you give to people who feel powerless or afraid?
It's understandable to feel powerless and afraid, but we will feel more powerless and more afraid to the extent that we become inert, to the extent that we're not able to be active. And I hear that a lot. People say, this is so discouraging. The news is so terrible. It makes me want to just turn away. But that, I believe, feels worse for people and gets worse outcomes. And so the truly enlivening possibilities are for us, not only individually, but in groups, collectively, organizing grassroots, local, regional, national, and really even international. It empowers us. It gives us the power to make the change for the better. You know, there have been terrible times before in this country after and during World War I. Eugene Debs and others were thrown in prison for stopping or wanting to stop, trying to stop an insane war. We had during the Vietnam War tremendous repression against anti-war activists. That came after the McCarthy era in the 50s. I almost said McCarthy error as well, but it was an error for this country, but it was intentional, as now the Trump administration is intentionally trying to crack down on dissent. But dissent is the lifeblood of democracy and our future. So I think often, and I put this as an epigraph in this book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, I'm lucky enough at Roots Action to work with India Walton, who is a terrific activist. She is a democratic socialist, was the Democratic nominee for mayor of Buffalo, New York. And I put in something that she said at a Roots Action meeting, and I jotted it down and put it in the book. She said, the only hope is in the struggle. And when people feel hopeless, The antidote to the poison of hopelessness is to be active and work with others to make progressive change.
My own view is that people act when they feel like they can actually do something, when they have some hope. And I think the example of that is right here in New York City, where I live. I live in Brooklyn, with Zohran Mamdani. I wanted to ask you what you thought of his campaign as a Democratic Socialist using the Democratic Party to get on the ballot, starting off at 1% and winning the race. How do you evaluate that victory?
Well, it goes to the point that hopelessness is a way that the system tries to crush us. And hope, not as an abstraction, but as a mobilization, is tremendously powerful. And so when we ended up with 80,000 to 100,000 volunteers, that is an example of how people can do what we are told is not possible, that they want to make change that is substantive, that can transform this country, not as individual actors or one famous leader, but understanding that this is a collective enterprise. And unlike the situation in Germany or Britain or France, we really don't live in a structure that is multi-party. I mean, I've heard really what I think are totally out of connection with reality assumptions that if we want to stop the fascistic Republican Party at a federal level, that means bypassing the Democratic Party. We may not like it. I don't like it. But I think the message is that Zohran Mamdani won because of people power. He showed that organized people can defeat organized big money. And he did it with a D after his name. And that is totally irrelevant. Doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat name after his name. What matters is that people organize and fight for power.
But the Norman, the Democratic Party is still so beholden as it is to corporate America as the Republican Party is. Has it learned that lesson that you're talking about?
Oh, I don't think at the top it's learned much lessons at all. But if you look at policy, the Democratic appointed members of the Supreme Court are different than the Republican ones. If you look at the antitrust or no antitrust at the Justice Department, tremendous difference. If you look at the crackdowns that are going on in city after city domestically, this is important. And so Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib, they would not be in Congress if they weren't part of the quote-unquote Democratic Party. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would be still a bartender. And there's nothing wrong with being a bartender. It's an honorable profession. But she's in Congress because she chose to run for the House of Representatives as a Democrat. If she hadn't chosen to do that, she would not be in the House of Representatives.
I wonder, could you tell us again, Norman, how people can get your book? Because our listeners may have missed it at the earlier part of this interview, but Blue Road to Trump Hill, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy, is a book that they can get for free. Am I right?
Yeah, I'm excited about that. And I've published 14 books now with a variety of publishers, from Common Courage Press, a small one, to Dell, a very large one. And it's always an experience of we're navigating a commercial terrain called book publishing. And so it's been necessary but frustrating to me over the last few decades to have books come out. And then people are told, well, if you want the book, you've got to pay $20, $25. So it's really exciting to me that from the outset, the book published here just in the last couple of weeks, I can say to people, yeah, if you need a print copy, you can go online and get it. But the vast majority of people who will read this book will read it for free. They'll read it as a PDF. They'll read it as an ebook. They can read it online or download it or whatever. And it's simple to do. You don't have to know anything technically. You just go to blueroad.info. That's blueroad.info. And as a result, I think it's a new way to publish books, which I think can have some real value.
Yes, absolutely. Blueroad.info.
Yes, blueroad.info. That's right.
INFO. All right. Well, Norman Solomon, we thank you for making this book available for free. And we certainly thank you for joining us again here on Law and Disorder.
Well, many thanks to the whole crew of Law and Disorder, to you, Jim, and Michael, and everybody else. We need independent radio, and we need all the voices that you bring on the air.
And we certainly appreciate having yours, my friend.
Thanks so much.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org, and there you'll learn ways to pledge your support for the show, and we appreciate that as well.
All the crew there. I didn't mention that there are illustrations, cartoons by Matt Werker. I guess that's how you say it, W-E-R-K-E-R. He's been around quite a bit. People might recognize his style, something like 17 cartoons. And you can go and look at them on the splash page, but you can read the whole book, yeah. WEFT end-of-year donation match. I don't know where we are, matching up to $1,500. Double your donation. If you want to go to weft.org and donate, that'd be a great time. I don't know. Tax deductions aren't as easily available for that anymore. That's been phased out thanks to Trump hell we're living in. But, well, it's relevant because we've had some a very generous donor who's anonymous, who's given us stock And there's a thing in donating stock to nonprofits. The appreciation value goes away. I don't know those details. I don't manage my own portfolio. They couldn't pay me enough to do that. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers. Let's carry it on. I'll definitely be editing the Fetraces interview about the origins of Jeffrey Epstein in Ohio. I don't know if they had any connections to Vance in the early days. I've heard there's a picture of a very young, boyish-looking Vance on the island in the Caribbean, or is it the Gulf of America? Maybe that's where he met Teal. I don't know. He's a conspiracy theorist, so why don't I propagate some of my own? Let's go now to Greg Pallas, not an election crimes bulletin, but a interview with Scott Harris of Behind the News. That's another chap. Between the Lines, BTL Online. This is not. This is something that's on Fridays as part of the Weft Courier, but the program is. But I don't think this section was actually in the broadcast section. Scott Harris talking to Greg Pallas. This is also about corporate Dems, if you will. The hook is Larry Summers and the leak of those documents, emails that put him out of public life, which we can be thankful for that, I guess. I was thinking about having time for some holiday music, seasonal music. I don't like much of it, frankly. There's a great song called What Are You Doing New Year's Eve that Katie Flynn rendered. And she's, speaking of holidays, she's going to be at the Rose Bowl on Christmas Day at 8 o'clock in the evening. So if you're at your wits, she's quite a hoot, quite a show. But I won't have time for it. But at least I pitched it. There's a birthday party over at the Urbana Dance Company tonight for the founder, Katie Ansolia. It's open to everyone, I guess. It's a great big wood floor put in for karate. But now it's dedicated to dance. And if you haven't been up there, it's worth the stairs. And anyway, I'm meandering here. Let's hear Scott Harris introduce Greg Pallas. It's a bit of a love fest, but that's cool.
And right now, I am very happy to welcome back to our program our good friend Greg Pallas, known for his investigative reports for The Guardian and best-selling books, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Greg's new film about the latest attacks on the right to vote that bent the 2024 election is titled Vigilantes Incorporated, America's New Vote Suppression Hitmen. That was narrated by Rosario Dawson and produced by Martin Sheehan. And Leonardo DiCaprio helped out on the film as well and released the film free for streaming that you can find at Greg Pallas' website, gregpallas.com. Greg, thank you so much for making time to come on our program again this evening. Appreciate it.
Thrilled to be back with you, Scott.
Thank you. So we're very happy that you can make it here this evening to discuss your investigation of some critical economic policies from recent American history that intersects with Jeffrey Epstein and some recently released email correspondence between Jeffrey Epstein, the late convicted sex trafficker of minors, and Larry Summers, President Clinton's Treasury Secretary. He was also Director of the National Economic Council for President Obama and Vice President at the World Bank. Summers is also, got a lot of titles, that guy. Summers also is past president of Harvard University. And as far as I know, he's still a professor there, although that may be in doubt. With this investigation, Greg, first tell us about the investigation you conducted into the plan for international banking deregulation back in 2013 and how these Epstein emails and his relationship with Larry Summers brought this important story back into focus.
Okay, well, first, if you follow the soap opera of Epstein, and it's serious stuff, is that Larry Summers, the most influential, powerful economist in the United States by far, again, former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, et cetera, World Bank, president of Harvard University, was hanging out, not only was using flying in Air Epstein, but Epstein was what he called his wingman in trying to seduce his protege, a young woman. Now, I understand Larry Summers is married to another Harvard professor, but he was spending time on in emails and God knows what else with Epstein, coming up with a strategy to use his influence and power over this young economist, basically to get her in the sack. You know, it's vile, it's evil, and it's a crime. Anyone else doing that would be arrested and certainly lose their job. And Harvard was very reluctant to even remove him as a professor. This is a big, so that's what the scandal story is.
Right.
But it is about power and money and influence. And this is the game that Larry Summers has played in the 30 years I've been investigating him, 30 years as an economist. In 1997, Larry Summers was actually at that time deputy Treasury Secretary and under Robert Rubin, who is the co-chairman just before Clinton made him secretary of Goldman Sachs. And Larry Summers was his associate. Timmy Geithner, who also became U.S. Treasury Secretary, all three became Treasury Secretary. Timmy Geithner was Summers' flunky. And he was sent to the World Trade Organization. Why? Because Summers, Rubin, and Geithner had this plan under Clinton that not only would they deregulate the banks, and that's important. Remember, it was under Bill Clinton that banks were deregulated. And, of course, George Bush took that opening and ran with it, and Trump even more. But it started with Bill Clinton deregulating the banking system, and which led, by the way, directly to the crash of 2007 to 2010 of the housing market, also directly caused the collapse of the Eurozone finances, because deregulation allowed the sale of derivatives, which are basically gambling. So what happened is that I got my hands on a memo when I was at The Guardian and BBC, and then I also wrote this up for Vice magazine, a memo called the Endgame Memo, which became quite famous in Europe. What it is a memo from Timmy Geithner, who was at the World Trade Organization as economic ambassador from the Treasury, to Summers, saying to Summers, listen, here's a list of five bank and finance CEOs. These are the personal numbers for John Reed at Citibank. You also had John Corzine, who had taken over at Goldman Sachs. You had Merrill Lynch. You had Bank of America. You had so you had five of the big giants of finance. This is a conspiracy nut's dream, because these five bankers with Summers, Rubin, and Geithner came up with a plan that would force all 156 nations within the World Trade Organization to deregulate their banks. I mean, there's no point, Scott, in deregulating American banks if smart people are going to say, why don't we go to England where they have or Germany where they have stronger protection laws for our money. Right. And so what they did was they said, here's our plan. If someone doesn't want to let Citibank buy your banks, or you won't accept our derivatives, you won't accept our – and let's not forget that Europe bought hundreds of billions of dollars in derivatives, which exploded and became nearly worthless, destroying those economies. I can tell you right now, I've, you know, one of my relatives in the Swiss army, in the Swiss national pension system, lost a big hunk of their pension because of their pension system buying into Goldman Sachs phony derivatives. That was the collapse. And so Summers came up with this plan with Geithner that in the endgame memo, what they were going to do is use what's called the Financial Services Agreement of the World Trade Organization. A little complex, but you can figure this one out. And they said to Ecuador, for example, and this is exactly what they said, you are a banana republic. If you don't accept our banks into your system, if you don't buy our derivatives and junk bonds, we will not buy your bananas. And then you and the monkeys can share the bananas while you go bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Ecuador signed. Mm-hmm. Same with all 156 members of the WTO except for Brazil, and which survived the great market crash of 2008 because they did not allow American banks or their toxic assets into their nation. That was under Lula, the current president.
Right.
Just said, I'm not doing it. So that's what happened. That's the end game memo. And we are all feeling the consequences even today.
Right. Well, that's what I'd like to get to because we're short on time. But I mm-hmm. wanted to ask about this endgame memo. Mm-hmm. When it contributed to the deregulation that brought down the economy in 2007 to 2010, as you said.
Yes.
How does that still impact us today? And I should note that you might want to also mention that during the Obama administration, many millions of people lost their homes, while no bankers were brought up on charges under Eric Holder, Obama's attorney general. There was a Wall Street crime spree without parallel. And President Obama, who's lauded as some kind of progressive, he oversaw millions of people lose their homes, but the bankers went scot-free.
Well, a couple things. Number one, when you talk about the bankers, remember one of the big backers of Obama was Robert Rubin. And now that was, again, the guy who was in charge of the whole end game scenario. And one of the things he did in bank deregulation was to destroy the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the great gift of Franklin Roosevelt to protect us from banking predators. What Glass-Steagall did, and this is important to understand, it said, okay, there's investment banking. That's a fancy word for financial speculation, you know, going to Vegas to gamble on derivatives.
Right.
And then there's commercial banking, which is that's where you put your savings. That's where you get a guaranteed $250,000, $500,000 guarantee for your bank account backed by the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve.
Right.
Now,
FDIC, right? Yeah.
FDIC. And then what happened is that under Clinton and Rubin, they smashed the barrier between these two and said, okay, Goldman Sachs, you can become a bank now, and you can take Citibank merged with American Express to create something called Citigroup, and they took trillions of dollars. I'm not talking billions. I'm talking trillions of dollars, and they gambled it. This is our government-guaranteed money. They gambled the government-guaranteed money in the derivatives market and got destroyed. They blew it all away. We ended up giving a bailout, which included $77.7 billion in guarantees for these banksters, at least $5 billion in direct payments to them. So if you're going to arrest anyone for the crime, you'd be arresting Rubin, who, by the way, what Rubin did, just so you know, after he smashed Glass-Steagall, allowing the creation of Citigroup, he was hired as the chairman of Citigroup, left the Treasury, went to Citigroup, and was paid a starting salary of $126 million, and then proceeded to blow $1 trillion, which we had to pay off so he could get his $126 million payday.
Yeah.
So the reason why these guys are not in jail is that they are Obama's good friends. In fact, Larry Summers came back in. He could not. Believe me, he could not get confirmed as Secretary of the Treasury. So they made his flunky Timmy Geithner Secretary of the Treasury, but put Summers over him in a job that did not have to be confirmed by the Senate, simply called the economic czar, chief economic advisor to the White House. So that's why you didn't get these guys arrested. That's why the banksters weren't arrested, because it would include the top Democrats who put Obama back in office. It's real simple.
We're speaking with Greg Palast, our good friend and longtime investigative reporter. He's also an economist, right? You used to lecture on economic issues at some of the most prestigious universities in the world. So Greg,
Harvard, Cambridge, Oxford.
So
that was in the days when I used to have a real job before I was a journalist.
That's when you started being friends with lowlifes like us. Thank you for that. Greg, I did want to ask you a final question. We are running out of time very quickly here. There's a lot of talk on Wall Street these days in terms of an artificial intelligence bubble. I've been hearing it increasingly over recent weeks. And I'm wondering, in terms of deregulation and things that should have been fixed that weren't fixed, replete with loopholes and all that, that is part of the government dysfunction, what do you foresee with this so-called AI bubble? Is it real, and should we be concerned about it?
Well, we should be concerned about it. I don't know if it's a bubble or a miracle. The internet changed productivity and it was wonderful, but it also led to massive implosion of some big corporations, especially because they decided, if you remember, that we needed massive fiber optics throughout the world. That led to the bankruptcy of giant corporations and had a tremendously negative effect on the market. I'm very concerned. And for example, under Moore's law, you have a new chip comes out about every 18 months. What's going to happen to the $1 trillion that are being spent on NVIDIA chips when 18 months from now, someone might come out with something which is a heck of a lot cheaper and doesn't require so much energy or so many chips? What are we going to do with all those billions of dollars in monster megalith plants out there? So, yeah, there's a danger. I can't predict where it will go. Right. But anyone who doesn't see that danger is operating blind. And the problem is we still have not fully restored the Glass-Steagall Act. And this all backs up into the finance system. These guys are gambling heavily. Once again, it's not as bad. AI is real. Derivatives were never real. Hey, J.P. Morgan had $88 trillion. I'm not making this up. $88 trillion on their balance sheets for derivatives as an asset. $88 trillion, that's more than the entire gross world production. Yes, I think that if we're not concerned and we don't go back to some type of tighter financial regulations, get ready. Get ready.
Cautionary tale from Greg Palast. That's off of btlonline.org. Scott Harris, that's a show that's on the Weft Courier on Friday afternoons into the evening. I did say that I wanted to play a bit of Bob Petraeus with Harvey Wasserman from a show called Green Power. So I'll just dedicate the last few minutes of the show to this. Heavy editing in the first place, and now I'm only going to hear 7 minutes of it. You can find it, I believe, at Green Power. I'll have that on the outro, I guess. Right. This is about the Ohio origins of Epstein. Since we didn't really learn much from the document dump, redaction, there was no penalty for not making the deadline. So, yeah, impunity.
So many ways, Jeffrey Epstein and all he has brought is a product of Central Ohio. Can you tell us how and tell us where Jeffrey Epstein really came from? Nobody else knows this story as well as you do, because you broke the first stories about Jeffrey Epstein, and you have the honor of having gotten a death threat from probably Jeffrey Epstein himself. So tell us where Jeffrey Epstein came from, please, Bob.
The first time I heard about Jeffrey Epstein was from the Inspector General of Ohio, David Sturtz. And basically, he's there to root out public corruption. And he said, do you know anything about Les Wexner's boyfriend, Jeffrey Epstein? So he was known as the boyfriend when I first knew him before his, you know,
penchant
for being predatory towards young women, is that he was thought to be the boyfriend. And he was also known as the valet. He would arrange things for Mr. Wexner.
So everybody, I'm not sure everybody in the call knows, certainly people who've been with us before have heard it, but Les Wexner, as Barb reported, through some serious mob connections, became a billionaire. He founded the Limited clothing chain and Victoria's Secret, Abercrombie Fitch, I guess, and he made billions based in Central Ohio in the women's clothing business. And he's still a billionaire. In my years of teaching, and you're looking behind me at my outdoor classroom at Capital University in Bexley, Ohio, I asked through the years, I taught there 14 years, many of my students who worked for the Limited, if Lex Wexner was gay. Nobody hesitated. Everybody said yes. And Jeffrey Epstein, who had a history of his own, but came to Les Wexner and somehow emerged with a lot of Les's money, like hundreds of millions of Les Wexner's money.
Showed up right about the time that Wexner's financial guy, Arthur Shapiro, was whacked mob style. And when a very famous memo came out called the Shapiro Murder File, which pointed out that Wexner had ties to organized crime. So you're talking about Jeffrey Epstein being the man who replaced the bookkeeper for one of the country's leading mobsters.
Right. So Wexner is rarely referred to as a mobster, but your reporting, and this is what earned you your death threat, I suppose. You know, there should be a merit badge on the left for death threats.
The death threat was, I got a letter to me saying that I was a candidate for a toe tag if I kept writing about Jeff Epstein. It wasn't a death threat in the name of Les Wexner. It was a death threat in the name of Jeff Epstein. I'm like, who the hell's Jeff Epstein?
Well, you found out and you broke the stories. So Jeffrey Epstein's origin story is that he somehow connected with the billionaire clothing magnate, Les Wexner, who's still alive, by the way, and gay though he may be.
We got to recall that Epstein handled all the logistics in terms of moving money around for Les Wexner.
Right. And they also had links to the CIA, because Epstein, and here's Steve Caruso has put up a bibliography here of Bob's reporting on Jeffrey Epstein. And this goes way back. What year did you break the first story about Jeffrey Epstein, Bob?
Around 92 was when, but that was local. I also broke some stories around the year 2000 as well, particularly Epstein's ties to the royal family. Prince Andrew, for example, and Epstein spent a lot of time together, as did, of course, Trump and Epstein.
Right. Now, when did you first detect a Donald Trump on the Wexner-Epstein radar?
Well, Nigel Rosser, who was a writer who was writing heavily in England for the Evening Standard, was able to come up and share it with me. No one in the U.S. had written anything about the ties between Epstein, Wexner, and Mar-a-Lago. One of the things that came out was that he told me that Epstein had just taken a trip, he and Ghislaine, with Prince Andrew, and the place they went was a place called Mar-a-Lago, which was owned by Trump. So that was one of his favorite places to go for.
So those of you now, I mean, everybody, of course, is following the Epstein story. Everybody's waiting for various shoes to drop. And the bottom line to know is that Jeffrey Epstein really had no money of his own. He had connections as well.
He was a math tutor.
Right. Apparently,
at an all-boys school.
And then he became a fixer for Les Wexner. And it's significant. Les Wexner's got to be in his 90s or late 80s anyway. I believe he's in his late 80s. He's still, a major figure financially. He established a housing development.
Talking about Epstein in Ohio, Bob Fichekas and Harvey Wasserman. And Green Power is not available as a podcast as far as I can tell, but that's the name of the show. If you wanted to hear the rest of it, there's some interesting items in that. Be back tomorrow with Jewish Voices for Peace, testimony from the West Bank. Some young woman was there recently. Thanks for listening. Lucky 13, Lucky 14 is the number up. Sorry. Urbana Arts is underwriting this next segment. Radio Free Labor, I haven't pitched them yet. Starbucks is on the docket, I suppose. I got to get out of here. Thanks for listening. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. And don't forget a possibility of a year-end donation to WEFT and community media in general.
Support for WEFT Radio comes from the Downtown Winter Lights, presented by the City of Urbana's Arts and Culture Program and Immersion Fest. For one-